This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One 1:30 in the afternoon here on TSN 1290, alongside Richard Pollock. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Currently, he is a player agent and a principal of Veritas Hockey. Previously, he was the assistant general manager of the Minnesota Wild. He's also a published author. The book is called How to Bake an NHL Franchise from Scratch, The First Era of the Minnesota Wild. It's available on Amazon and Kindle and Kobo. Pleased to welcome back to the show, Tom Lynn. Tom, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, man, and don't forget I'm still practicing law for all your legal needs down here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, in the Twin Cities, we'll grant you that, but we have our own lawyer in studio for your legal needs here in Winnipeg.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's great.
Tom, obviously, got to start with this new book, and it's a terrific read. We recommend it to everybody, and we'll send out a link to it as well. Why did you decide to write a book about your experiences as the assistant general manager of the Minnesota Wild?
Yeah, it wasn't a decision so much as a process, or process, I should say, for your audience. After I left the Wild, and a whole bunch of us, new owner came in and fired us all, so Rise Brow and me and Tommy Thompson and Chris Snow and so many people moved on, and working for the Flames and the Rangers and the rest, but we get together, you know, we see each other on the road, we talk, an occasional holiday, and for the first couple of years afterwards, we'd swap stories, and inevitably someone would say, boy, there should be a book about this, or someone should write a book. And Chris Snow, who now works for the Flames, was the writer. He'd worked for the Boston Globe, and he didn't have time to undertake it. And Tommy Thompson from Winnipeg there is a great writer, but he's full-time with the Rangers as well, and he wasn't doing it. So I decided to put together a series of blogs, because the hockey news in some places are always bugging me for content. And I thought, well, how about, 10 or 12 blogs, some of the good stories. But once I started writing it here and there, on road trips and hotels or on airplanes, I quickly came up with, I think 20 after a couple months, and it was over 80 pages, and I thought, this is probably a book, and it eventually evolved into a book over a year and a half.
It's a really good read, Tom. As Drew mentioned, I have it on Kindle, and when you're reading the book, and you really detail working for Doug Risebrow, who people may know from his Montreal days, Calgary days, and of course Minnesota days, what was the most fulfilling part for you of working for Doug Risebrow, and conversely, what was the most frustrating part?
Oh, it was just funny. I was thinking about that today because I thought about something Doug had once said to Tommy and I. Now, Tommy Thompson from Winnipeg there was a lawyer as well, a trial lawyer like me before we get into hockey. And he said to us once after the trade deadline, he said, Tom, meaning me, Tommy Lynn, you seem to remember everything you read. And you, Thompson, you seem to remember everything you hear. He was a little bit irritated, I think. But it just goes to show you Doug's powers of observation were always amazing. I learned so much from that, from being someone who's really wedded to the written word and being a lawyer and very logical and the rest. Doug was intuitive. We'd walk out of meetings sometimes, whether it was Jacques or the ownership or a player we were interviewing, and he would have insights that I had not picked up on. But once he spoke them, I'd say, okay, now I saw what you saw, but now I see how you put it together, why that player will work for us, why that one won't. But the players he got early on, like Wes Walls and Antti Luoksonen and Philip Kuba, guys who had been discarded by NHL teams, but in talking to them, watching them, he knew they could make it. That insight he had was the amazing thing. And the negative side, sometimes that insight, I couldn't get in touch with it. We're very different people. So we clashed often, and I love that. I mean, I come from a big family. We fight a lot, and we argue a lot. Doug and I were very, very close, and still are. But if for an outsider walking to the office and hear him yell at me and me yell back something from office to office, you'd think we were sworn enemies because we made it like an old people's marriage. We made it together, but we were always arguing.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Tom Lynn, currently a player's agent for Veritas Hockey, author of a new book called How to Bake an NHL Franchise from Scratch, The First Era of the Minnesota Wild. Tom, in the book, you outline the impact that one person in particular had on the Wild organization, despite the fact that they never actually worked for the organization. Can you describe the impact that Scotty Bowman had on the beginning and the origins of the Minnesota Wild?
Yeah, I mean, that could be... I made it a subsection of the book, but it could have been even longer had I wanted to bore the reader even more. 500 pages. I'd say, in summary, it's something... I noticed the culture that we were building from early on, through the first 2 years, and then one day, Doug and I, as often he would do, he'd give me a nice lecture on something in hockey, and I really learned a lot. I think we were on an airplane. He said, "Who do you think had the most effect on our organization?" So by then, I think we had just finished a playoff run in 03 and had been a very successful run. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it. I thought about the owner buying the team and setting the tone, and Jack Sperling as the president, and Doug as GM for a while, and Jacques, who had so much to do with it. So I picked Jacques, and he said, "Well, you're kind of right." He said, "It's Scotty Bowman." I said, "How?" He said, "Look, we all played for Scotty." When he said we all, he meant Mario, he and Jacques. The three of us played for Scotty in Montreal. That's how we learned about hockey. We came out of high school to play, really. We were young men and spent our formative years with him. So how you practice, what time you eat, how you treat players, how you treat the game, how important things are. He said the attention to detail in this defensive approach. Now, the Canadians gave up the fewest goals in the league the 4 years running when they won the Stanley Cups in the 70s. So he said the attention to detail, the defense, the coverage, all that comes from Scotty. And you add in Mike Ramsey, another assistant coach who played for Scotty with three teams. And you add in Guy Lapointe, who was number two in the scouting ranks, and he had learned under Scotty in the 70s how to recognize players. He said, indirectly, we all learned from Scotty. It's kind of like a Bill Walsh, you know, coaching the 49ers years ago, producing so many head coaches in football, and he affected the NFL so much. Scotty has done the same thing with the Wild, the Blackhawks, the Red Wings, and so on.
When you're reading the book, when people, of course, encourage people to pick it up, Tom, you have a really interesting chapters on the expansion draft, and people forget, and I forgot, the rules that the NHL implemented in terms of drafting a certain number of players from certain teams, and if you drafted goaltenders, then what would happen? And you took a really interesting angle, the Wild did, and with your thought process behind that, in terms of mapping out a way to draft with Columbus, who you were coming into the National Hockey League with, in order to maximize the return that both of you could get out of the expansion draft. But that, you know, almost fell by the wayside there with Doug McLean in Columbus. Can you tell, you know, the listeners some of the stories about Doug McLean and maybe him being a little bit, shall we say, temperamental?
Yes, he definitely flies by the seat of his emotional pants in his career there, which was opposite from us. I find it fascinating right now because there's talk of expansion in the NHL. Whether it be one or two teams, it probably needs to be two. And an expansion draft now would be guided mostly by analytics, I think, somewhat by culture. But just imagine you all had 1,400 players to choose from in an expansion draft for next year between draft picks, AHL players and NHL players. You'd have spreadsheets and records and analytics all over the place, whereas in our day, we were attempting to do analytics, but it was by cut and paste. It was by trying to do it. It's almost like piloting an airplane with charts back 25 years ago before it went to GPS. And so we had set up a whole system of analytics with a large staff. We went through mock drafts and really looked at how the expansion draft could develop if Columbus took player A and we took player B. Next time around, if they took player B, we took player A. Next time around, if they took player C, who would we take? Mm-hmm. And so with the rules of the expansion draft saying that if you lost a goalie, you couldn't lose a defenseman and vice versa, and you could only lose two players total, there were countless iterations of how many expansion drafts could be had. And so we went through it all and discovered that if Columbus and the Wild came together and formed an agreement by which we both privately agreed which players we'd take, we could screw the current teams. The current teams are trying to screw us by only leaving available in the expansion draft.
That's right, yeah.
A few good players, you know? Sorry.
No, go ahead, Tom.
Too fast. But we're going to leave a few good players and a lot of bad ones, and then the two teams, Columbus and Minnesota, would battle each other for those and X out a lot of teams. If we could come to an agreement and divide up the good players, as it were, not taking a lot of salary, we'd both win. So we came to that agreement couple days or a day or so before the expansion draft, and then it all broke apart a little after 11 o'clock at night, the night before the expansion draft. So we went back to the drawing board.
And that was, you know, Doug McLean's reaction and bailing out, and you've obviously picked up the book to read more about that. Tom, you also mentioned many things in the book that I found very interesting, but something else that I found interesting in the book was the fact that the Wild players, and certainly Jacques Lemaire plays a large part in this, will actually end up likely getting more through arbitration in terms of dollars than they would on the open market because of how playing for the Wild kind of inflated their statistics and used, for example, Andrew Burnett, who people probably remember, and now he's an assistant coach with the Wild, as an example of that.
Yes, and it was a phenomenon that I identified in our second year, but became a real point of contention, and I was the only contract negotiator there, so it was mostly settled upon me. You get a lot of players. I mean, all players make the NHL had success, right? Everyone was going to be great in junior or college and the rest. And a number of the players that came to us had not had the success in their careers they'd wanted or expected. So they come out of the minors, they come out of Europe, they come out of situations where they're not everyday players of their NHL teams, and all of a sudden they're put with the Wild. Andrew Burnett's a good example. He'd had some success, but never really been wanted, been exposed in two expansion drafts and drafted late by the Capitals. So he comes to us and gets a bunch of points, but with so many players we had, if we set them free, if we didn't re-sign them, like as we did with Brunette and Loxonen, they often signed for less elsewhere. So we get in an arbitration situation where they'd have comparable players, say a 15-goal guy with Detroit, a 15-goal guy with the Rangers, a 15-goal guy with the L.A., and I'd have to say, look, those teams are going to pay them a lot more. If I set you free in the market, you don't have Jacques, you don't have our culture to support you, they're going to see you as the same player who struggled up and down from the minors your whole career. That's a tough thing to say to a player as an agent. And it could become acrimonious. I really had to stick handles through it. But the truth was borne out by history. Is Brunette, I think he was in the 1.4 to 1.7 range his last arbitration year, just at the lockout there. And the next year he signed with Colorado for $850 a year, which just shows the vast difference that our, I shouldn't say overpricing, the value added by the Wild's culture and coaching really made a difference to what players could make.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is player agent Tom Lynn. Tom is currently a principal with Veritas Hockey. He's formerly the assistant general manager of the Minnesota Wild. He's also the author of a book called How to Bake an NHL Franchise from Scratch, the First Era of the Minnesota Wild. It's available on Amazon.
If you listen now, let's quickly cut in here. If you listen to this show, you should be getting that book.
That's pretty much it.
That's awesome.
Tom, as always, as an assistant general manager and in your role, there's always some awkward situations. Probably one that would be up at the top of the list is the time you had to drive Billy Tibbetts to the airport after you had to cut him because he had been arrested. How was that car ride for you?
Yeah, I didn't put it in the book, and I wanted to be fair to Billy as well, who's still out there trying to make his way in the world. But I think your listeners would remember Billy Tibbetts well enough from his days in the NHL. He had been a good junior player, but he spent some time in jail on a statutory rape charge, I think between the age of 19 or 21 or thereabouts. Came back into hockey, eventually made it as a regular player with the Penguins before flaring out up and down. He was a Wild player. He was a fighter. He got suspended quite often in all the professional leagues he played in, and he had a heck of a reputation and a lot of tattoos. So one year in Houston, we were looking like we might not make the playoffs. One of our few times under Todd McClellan, we had 8 games left, and we weren't quite tough enough or character enough. So I told him I was signing Billy Tibbetts out of the ECHL on a PTO, pro tryout. And boy, the coaches didn't like that. And I said, look, you're not winning. I'm your manager. So I'm going to have to do it. If you guys are winning, I wouldn't have to do this. So we bring Billy in, covered with tattoos. I don't know if he was on steroids, but he looked like a bodybuilder in the locker room. And the players were afraid of him. The coaches were afraid of him. Cam Stewart used to keep a stick with him at all times, he said, just in case Billy lost his temper. Walking around the locker room, there's Cam with a stick. And Cam was a pretty tough player. So he had them all scared good. But my deal with Billy, and I really liked Billy, I got along with him well, was if you get in any trouble, you're gone. Like, no discussion, no appeal, no nothing. This is your last chance of last chances. And he agreed. And then after a playoff loss one night, he was arrested for rolling through a stop sign in Houston and then just losing his mind to the cops. They told me later, we didn't want to arrest him, but he kept screaming at us and pounding on our car. They arrested him, and the next day I told my boss, Risebrow, I said, well, you got to cut him. But Risebrow said, look, you signed him. It's not the staff's fault, the trainers, the usual guys that drive to the airport. You go tell him in his apartment he's cut, and then you drive him to the airport and get him out of town. If he gets arrested again, we're going to look bad. So off I go to Billy's apartment. I have to explain to him he's cut. I got to go through the tears and the yelling and everything else, get in the car, and then there's traffic. There's construction. It's Houston. I got 2 hours to get to the airport. I'm gripping the wheel. I'm taking side streets. He starts telling me, well, we're not going to make the flight, Mr. Lynn. And I said, oh, no, we're going to make the flight. We're going to make this flight. I went up the side at one point off an off-ramp and through. I pulled up to the, where you drop off people at the airport. I screeched to a halt. was throwing his bags out of the trunk because he said, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I said, good luck, Billy, you'll make it. And I hopped in the car and took off, and I heard his entire life story in those 2 hours in the car. And it was tough stuff, but that's part of being an assistant GM.
Our guest is Tom Lynn, author of How to Bake an NHL Franchise from Scratch, the first era of the Minnesota Wild. Now, Tom, I've never had the pleasure of playing hockey with you, but given that you're the assistant general manager for an NHL franchise, there's a big sheet of ice usually right in front of you. It stands to reason that there'd be some staff hockey games. Fortunately, yeah. you had a pretty decent staff in which to play hockey with. How was it playing in games with guys like Jacques Lemaire, Doug Risebrough, and the litany of ex-NHLers that are in front offices around the NHL?
That was cool. I mean, the coolest part is probably the people you play with. It's like the AHL, every year the AHL does an all-star game where the GMs play each other, and I got to play with Thomas Steen and Dan Bylsma and guys like that, actually in Winnipeg a few years ago. But the great thing about the Wilds thing was Jacques would cancel practice rarely, maybe once a month, maybe twice, where he'd give the players a day off. But on those days, then we were allowed to take the ice the team had, whether on the road or at home, so we'd bring our stuff with us. So on a given day, it would be the trainers, all of whom played hockey, Tony DeCosta, the equipment manager, is a goalie from Winnipeg, and Don Fuller is a player from British Columbia. Then you had Jacques and Mario that often play, sometimes play goalie. And Jacques would yell at me, keep it down, keep the puck low. But we had a great time spinning around. And, of course, there were always players. So if Gabrick or Bouchard or Brad Brown or anyone was coming back from injury, they might be on your line as well. So from being a JV college player who gave up the sport at age 20, so many years later I'd be streaking down the ice yelling to Gabrick for the puck, and it was fun.
Tom, you've mentioned Winnipeg a few times in the interview, and Don Baisley, of course, the late Don Baisley, you had a relationship with, and you make an interesting point in the book, very interesting point, I thought, that Don Baisley taught you that sometimes negotiations were more simple than they appeared, in that they really were based on leverage, and if you had it, you could use it, and if you didn't, well, then you couldn't. Can you expand on that and also your relationship with Don?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I wouldn't be an agent now if it weren't for Don. Because the cadre of agents have a poor reputation generally, not because all of them, because of the worst guys. And I didn't want to be stained with it. I didn't want to compete with some of these people who are less than honest. And when I was deciding whether to be an agent or not over 3 months, I spoke to Don. And I realized, here's a man who I respect as much as anyone in hockey, or any lawyer I know. He did it the right way. He was very honest, and he was very straightforward. And I thought, if I can be like Don, then this is something I can pursue with honor. So I owe him a lot for that. But what he taught me in negotiation was, he said, look, Tom, and he was right. He said, if I have a player and there's two other players like him and trying to place him as a free agent, if I'm yelling at GMs or being mean-spirited or trying to catch them on this and that, they're going to call someone else. Unless my player is clearly better. But if they're in the mix and we all have right wings that are 18 goal scorers, I want to do the right thing here. So the leverage, the amount of money that this player can get in the market, that's my fulcrum. So if I know he's a $700,000 player, that's what I play to. And we did that with Kai Nerman, a Finnish player he signed. Mm-hmm. He said, all the smoke and mirrors, plenty of stuff in the press and the rest, you can just irritate the management. They're pretty sophisticated. They know what they should pay, and it's about the leverage. And I'd note that Don was not an easy negotiator. When Don said to you, this player is worth a certain amount, you paid it, eventually, as the Ducks found out with Paul Kariya after a 52-goal season. But there wasn't any yelling or name-calling. Or, you're going to lose, and this and that. Don would just politely say, okay, well, thank you for the offer. My client is not prepared to play for that, and you have my number, and call me when you're ready. And that's how he negotiated. He knew the numbers, and he stuck to them.
Tom, we'll let you go on this last question, and we've talked about your time as the assistant general manager, and of course we mentioned off the start that you're currently a player agent with the Veritas Hockey. How has your time in the front office really prepared yourself as an agent in the NHL in this day and age?
Well, that's a good question, because the reality of a lot of things is different than the outside. You found that in your own lives, we always do. So the reality of being a head coach as opposed to an assistant coach, it really makes a change. Assistant GM to GM, it looks different even though you're right next to it. And for my part, seeing what really happens in an NHL draft table, both good and bad, and understanding how amateur scouts and organization scouts and how the NHL puts pressure on teams and how they do the contract negotiation, how their arbitration process works and all that. So I learned that not only for the Wild but for the whole league, because I was involved as a fairly successful assistant GM in some policy setting. So flipping that to the other side, when I speak to a player and the mystery of I just got drafted by the Blackhawks. What does that mean? The mystery of that for the player, I can say to them, well, here's what it means from the other side. Here's what they expect. Here's what they want. I know Stan Bowman personally. I know the scout that drafted you. So it's a different perspective because I was sitting in the room, the old fly in the wall, for 9 years. and at the same time, in the agent world has been a learning experience for me. Amateur hockey was largely not open to me because I was a pro guy on the other side. So now I'm going to Bantam Midget Games for the last 5 years. I've learned a lot about developing players who are 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, and what I can give them is the perspective that when they sign an NHL deal, what does this mean to the organization? Why are they sending you to Binghamton? Is there a good restaurant in Binghamton? I even know that. But it helps a lot.
Tom Lynn is the author of How to Bake an NHL Franchise from Scratch, the first era of the Minnesota Wild. It's available on Amazon and really wherever you would find books in this day and age. Tom, appreciate the time as always, and we'll hopefully see you soon in Winnipeg.
You'll see me very soon. I guess I owe you guys a trip to a deli somewhere.
You don't have to tell us twice. We'll meet you there. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. All the songs you've heard today so far on the show have been deliberately picked because our producer, operator, Chris Curry over here, his band, New Nova, tonight at Le Garage. What time are you guys taking the stage, Chris? 10 p.m.
10 p.m. and he's gonna.
You're gonna hit these high notes on this song.
The darkness.
I know the darkness.
Chris, pop on here for a second.
Yeah, you can turn your mic on there for a second. If we let Remus talk, we'll certainly let you talk.
Yeah. All right.
You guys. So 10 p.m. tonight, and you can hit these high notes. I mean, this is pretty high.
I can try to hit these notes. Yeah, I'm definitely gonna do my best. But we're going at 10 o'clock. A lot of good food. Even better music, so.
And cold beer. I assume there'll be some cold beer available.
Oh, there's gonna be tons. Yeah. Blowing out the taps.
The band is called New Nova tonight at Le Garage. What is it with our producers and the playing bands? Producer Tim, of course.
Of course.
Plays in a band. Producer Chris plays in a band. Remus plays garage band on Xbox.
Timmy's band's a little bit more of a kind of a jam out band.
Yeah.
Sounds like Chris has got a classic rock band. I love it. I mean, you're playing some newer stuff too. I mean, you said you're playing Wolfmother.
Yeah, we did some Wolfmother, yeah.
Which Wolfmother song are you playing again?
Woman. That awesome. Really, really high one.
Yeah, you're singing Woman, and you're singing the Darkness song that you just played there. Wow.
A couple of Led Zeppelin tracks, so we go a little bit further back, too, but some stuff in the 2000s. So.
Robert Plant's got nothing on you.
Check it out tonight at Le Garage, 10 p.m. They're going to hit the stage. I'm assuming you have to get in line probably by 6 or so, right?
Yeah, I haven't marked it down. You could be there for like 8:30. Lots of food, so you can have yourself a nice dinner there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Drew,
so
if you go, then you can just literally roll over to the river in the morning.
That's right.
Breakfast with Bernstein.
That's right. Breakfast, exactly. Go straight from the garage, just roll down the river, and
not somebody's
perfect.
Garage,
Le Garage. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
don't show up to my garage. You want to go to Pavanche there? Yeah.
Trade deadline rapidly approaching. Before you know it, it'll be about 5 weeks away now. It'll be on Monday, March the 2nd. Of course, a special edition of NHL Midweek as part of our day-long coverage here on TSN 1290. Travis Yost, the TSN.ca analytics correspondent, I guess, for lack of a better word, was looking at some potential Jets targets. You know, some players the Jets might be identifying to shore up that third line right wing spot that everyone's sort of pointing at as a weakness for the team, all due respect to Matt Halaschuk. And going with the assumption, you know, the Jets aren't going to pay big money, they're not going to break the bank and mortgage the future for a player to fill that role. So he was looking at some, you know, potential rentals who might be available, who would fit the Jets' needs and what they like to do possession-wise. And the two guys he came up with...
What everybody likes to do possession-wise.
Right, what everyone likes to do. That's right. Most teams, I suppose, in this day and age. Yeah, they all... Yeah. Now that the Leafs are on board, I guess it's every team now. And he identified two guys.
Doing the side. I don't think that Leafs weren't... You know, I don't think Andy Carlo went to the locker room and said, hey, guys, you know what? Don't touch the puck tonight. All right. Just make sure you don't touch it.
I'm being tongue-in-cheek. Okay. So he looked at two guys who are on expiring contracts, who have small salary cap hits and who won't cost the Jets a ton to acquire.
Yeah, which is the reasonable situation here. The Jets aren't going to take on too much money, you don't think, and they're not going to trade any of their really young players here. So, I mean, that's logical for sure.
That's right. And the two guys he identifies are Sean Bergenheim, currently with the Florida Panthers, and Eric Condra of the Ottawa Senators.
Yeah, I know they both had very strong seasons in terms of the Corsi figures and different stats and relative Corsi and different things that come into it there. You wonder if, you know, Bergenheim is an interesting one. I don't know enough about either player to really comment on their skill set too much. Bergenheim, you wonder what it would cost. Condra, you wonder why they would move him. It just seems like not an expensive player. Now, both of those teams conceivably have a difficult time making cash, right?
Sure.
So if that's the case, I mean, isn't Condra a guy you could re-sign for fairly reasonable dollars? You wonder if they would trade him. And then if you look at Florida, well, it's a little bit different in the sense of, you know, what's Bergenheim going to command as a free agent? And I don't know. I think both of them would be fine fits in Winnipeg. I think that's a good option. I've mentioned before Drew Stafford, I think, would add a little more of a skill element.
Cost you a little bit more as a result.
I don't know how much more Drew Stafford cost you, Drew. In all honesty, I don't know. I mean, if you look at the numbers, these guys, the numbers aren't much different. I mean, Drew Stafford, talent-wise, I think he's more talented than both of those players. I think he would add a nice skill element to that right side if it was on the third line. So that's one player. There's other players, too. I know we're up against it. There's other players to consider as well. But I have no issue with those two players being suggested either.
Drew Stafford, 22 points in 42 games for the Buffalo Sabres so far. Again, on the UFA at season's end. Eric Condra, he's got 8 points in 32 games for the Ottawa Senators.
Doesn't have the same skill set as Drew Stafford.
No, Drew Stafford was highly touted.
He's a good player, but he's gotten lost in Buffalo, and his at times his focus has not necessarily been there. But again, skill wise, hands wise, he exceeds both those guys.
And Sean Bergenheim with 16 points, 7 goals, 9 assists in 33 games.
Yeah, and obviously been put in situations where he's defending quite a bit. Or starting in defensive zone and things like that. So there are factors that go beyond just what their output has been. But those are guys to consider as well. If other teams fall out of it, maybe other players become available. And I don't think this is a trade that needs to be done tomorrow. This is a trade that I don't think there's going to be any trades from the Jets' perspective for a little bit here, because you let the next little bit play out. Oh, you think you have all the defensive depth. Well, if one of those guys goes down, maybe you don't, right? And
sure,
maybe you need one of those defensemen. And certainly, if you want to make a run in the playoffs, you need more than eight defensemen at least. So I don't think it's something that you want to rush, and a lot of teams are going to fall out of it now in the next little bit. And then that opens up doors to possible other options. And then, of course, if you have more options, and you can probably give up less to get a player. So those are guys you keep an eye on, but it's not like Travis Yost, who did a good job. It's not like the teams haven't examined those as well, and other teams would be interested in those players. And this is something that'll play out over the next, today's January 24th.
5 weeks.
So 5 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, give or take, probably 5 weeks exactly come Monday.
I don't think you'll see too many crazy moves until that week before the deadline. Then you'll probably see more action.
It's always an entertaining time, and it'll be especially entertaining for Jets fans as they are right in the thick of things in the NHL's Western Conference and the Central Division. Let's head to break. When we come back, we head out to New York City and talk about the New York Rangers with Andrew Gross from the Record newspaper. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Two hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Alongside Richard Pollock, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Record newspaper in New Jersey. He covers the New York Rangers, Andrew Gross. Andrew, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good talking to you guys again.
Likewise, Andrew. Andrew, got to start with the big news out of the Rangers camp in the last couple weeks, and that was the re-signing of Mark Stahl to a contract extension. Did you ever have any doubt that it was going to get done and that Stahl was not going to make it to unrestricted free agency at season's end?
Well, I thought it was going to happen. I mean, I think as a Ranger fan, you hoped it was going to happen. But after last season, when you saw what happened with Ryan Callahan, yeah, you know, I mean, this is the reality of a free agency, salary-capped world. You know, long-standing teammates, you know, get traded or, you know, or leave. But I think it's a very good thing for the team to get them locked up. You know, it's kind of a rarity, like I say, in the cap world. I know the Blackhawks have it going on with the guys they've got locked up long term. But the Rangers you see on the ice and you have seen on the ice is going to be the team that you continue to see on the ice long term. You know, Lundqvist has signed long term, Stahl signed long term, Ryan McDonough signed long term, Dan Girardi signed long term, Rick Nash has signed long term. This is your team. And you know, Mark Stahl is a very important piece to that. And, you know, what, based on what they had given Girardi, he slotted in just about right where he was supposed to.
Andrew, you know, we were doing kind of an all-star team last week and looking at the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference. I know they don't do that format anymore. But you look at the, you know, left side D in the Eastern Conference, and you could argue Mark Stahl is certainly among the top three of that group. And how good is Stahl? I think sometimes people don't realize how effective he can be.
Yeah, you know, it's been my pleasure covering the Rangers. You know, there are certain guys you kind of focus on. I love watching goalies, so, you know, being around Lundqvist on a daily basis has been a treat. But the guy next to me down the rung, I mean, and Ryan McDonough is certainly up there because he's a very special player. But, you know, you watch the stuff Mark Stahl does, and some of it's subtle and some of it is just overly physical. And, I mean, I'm not trying to say he's got the reach that Zdeno Chara has, but in a lot of ways he gums up the works along the boards just because he does have that long reach, and then he's very good at pinning opponents and, you know, not giving forwards coming in any time and space to operate. So you know, a lot of what he does is very fun to watch on a defensive end. I know Alain Vigneault would like a little bit more offense out of him, and I think Mark Stahl, you know, would like a little more offense out of him too. But, you know, at this point, and having gone through the injuries he's gone through, you know, with the two concussions and loss of eyesight in his right eye, you know, he is what he is, which is a stalwart defensive player. And on any other team, he's a top line player, but because the Rangers also have McDonough, like you say, on that left side, Mark Stahl typically plays on the second pair.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Andrew Gross, who covers the New York Rangers for the Record newspaper. Andrew, you look at the Rangers and you look at their roster and you look at Derek Stepan, 1.03 points per game, granted a little banged up for a period of time, but 32 points in 31 games played for the Rangers. Has he taken the next step in his career development to become a top-line NHL centerman?
Yeah, I really think he's one of the smartest players on the team in just how he sees the ice and just, you know, you saw it, the two games, really, he was out of the lineup. He got dinged up, I think it was his arm, ribs area, his torso gets dinged up, and he misses, you know, most of that game against the Islanders, and then he misses all of the game against the Bruins, and it's no coincidence the Rangers lost both games 3-0, and then as soon as he gets back into the lineup, they, you know, they've won their next three games, including a game at Pittsburgh, and he just balances out that lineup so much. You know, he's another guy. He's their next priority when it comes to contracts. He's going to be an RFA again. He's 24 years old, but, you know, I think it's really time for the Rangers to step up and, no pun intended, and really, you know, he deserves, and for the Rangers, you know, we talked about the core of the team being together. It behooves both sides to get a long-term deal done, and the very starting point is the 5 years, $5 million that they gave Derek Brassard, you know, their other top six center over this summer, and it would seem to me that Step is going to, you know, easily beat the $5 million annually that Brassard got.
You mentioned Broussard, and he has performed quite well, Andrew, so far this year. He's got 35 points in 42 games, and a guy's kind of exceeded my expectations for him. Why has he been so successful this year?
Well, he's developed a really good chemistry with that, you know, with that line. Rick Nash and Matt Zuccarello is, you know, obviously Rick Nash is having, you know, an MVP type season, and you know, Brass is a part of that. He's very good at setting up Rick. They kind of know where each other's going to be on the ice. So, you know, it's funny because you would think that, you know, the line with Rick Nash is obviously your top line, and then you talk about Derek Steffen being, you know, the team's top line center, and he's playing with Chris Kreider and Marty St. Louis, which, you know, could also be considered a top line. So the Rangers, the top six, you know, it's really lines 1-1A right there. But, you know, Brass is really matured. He's, you know, you talk about Steph being a smart player, and you say the same thing about Brass. You know, he just sees the ice well, and he's smart enough to feed Rick Nash, you know. So that's worth $5 million a year.
Our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is Andrew Gross of the Record newspaper. He covers the New York Rangers. Andrew, I'm going to ask you about two straight college free agents that the Rangers have signed over the last number of years. First one is Kevin Hayes, playing a regular shift for the Rangers. He's got 16 points in 41 games so far this season. How has he looked in his first year with the Rangers, and how has he progressed throughout the season, to your mind?
He is progressing, and I think the next hurdle he's got to get through is they can't trust him yet on faceoffs, really, in the defensive zone. That's been a real issue for the team. But, you know, he comes in, obviously, he was a first-round pick of the Blackhawks, never signed with that organization, spent 4 years at Boston College, and comes right out of college into the program, into the NHL, which is a really big leap. And a lot of it was out of necessity over, you know, through training, because Steph broke his left leg, and they needed a center. I mean, they were so desperate, they were playing Marty St. Louis at center early in the year. But, you know, he's come in, and he's kind of solidified the position. You know, he's a... like I said, he's been bad on faceoffs, but he's a very confident in his abilities type of kid. He feels like he belongs. He handles the puck very well. He's not quite there yet on distributing the puck. He's very strong on the puck. He gets the puck to the crease off, and he needs to work on, you know, finding his teammates a little bit once he does get the puck down low. But, you know, in terms of what the Rangers' needs were, the fact that he was able to, you know, kind of morph into an NHL player this quickly really helped the organization out of a bind early in the season.
Andrew, you mentioned Rick Nash earlier. You've covered him for a few years now. Is this the best that you've ever seen Rick Nash play?
Yeah. Yeah, I know early in his career in Columbus, he had that 41-goal season. He had a couple of 40-goal seasons there. But I think he's better because, I mean, you don't see it in the stats, but he's really become a two-way forward. And you don't think of that, you know, with Rick Nash. But, you know, I've been all over his defensive game. I think the way he plays in his own end has been really good. His back-checking is strong. Never gives up on a puck. I mean, to be honest, that's impressed me as much as the fact that he's been able to sustain his goal scoring, because he's always been such a streaky player, and for him to, he's never gone through a dip yet this season. And you know, we were talking about that before the All-Star game, and he's pretty much as amazed that there's been no dip as anyone else, because that's been the way he's been throughout his career. But he really is a complete package. I mean, you know, AV relies on him on the penalty kill as much as the power play, and that's about as big a compliment as you can give a forward.
Andrew, wanted to ask you about Cam Talbot. He signed a one-year contract extension to be with the Rangers organization for an additional year. What does the future hold for him after that one-year extension is up? I mean, does he want to be a starter? Obviously, he would want to be a starter in the NHL, but that's not going to happen in New York. How do you see that playing itself out?
Yeah, you know, he was pretty honest about that when he signed the deal. The way he's looking at it, he loves working with the Rangers goalie coach, Benoit Lair. And the way he's looking at this is another year, one more season, where he can really learn under one of the NHL's top goalie coaches. And, you know, Benoit Lair has taken Cam Talbot's game and completely, he broke it down and just built it up in ways that Cam Talbot could have never imagined when he was at Alabama Huntsville. He's a completely different player in his technique. You know, he plays a little bit more like Hank now. You know, he was kind of, as he says, he was much more out of the crease all over the place as a college goalie and when he first got into pro hockey. He definitely wants to be a starter. He knows it's not going to happen in New York. I think the sense I got was he could have tested free agency. He could have seen if there was a team that wanted him to at least compete for a starting job. But I think with the money that he was offered by the Rangers, you know, about, I don't have it right in front of me, I think it was 1.4 or 1.5, whatever it was. It was a nice raise. I think he thought for his development, the best thing he could do is spend one more year with the Rangers and then, you know, he can hit the market after that season. And he might be ready at that point to, you know, really be an NHL starter at that point. Cause, you know, don't forget, even though he's only 27, 28, he's, I don't want to say behind in his development, but, you know, from where he started, he's kind of where a 23 or 24 year old goalie might be. So, you know, I think he thinks he has time. And he needs just a little bit more to build up his game.
I'd rather spend another year in New York than Edmonton as well.
Yeah, well.
Final question for you, Andrew. And coming up now, the Rangers obviously have been playing really well and really kind of geared up here as the season goes on, and a team that made the finals last year, as everybody knows. What are Glenn Sather and Jeff Gordon going to be looking to add, if anything, in the next, you know, 5 weeks?
You know, I think they go into the trade deadline looking like any team. You know, I think for defensemen first. If they could get a big physical defenseman, put him on the third pair, that would be really good for the team. You know, John Moore is going to be a restricted free agent after this season. Matt Hunwick's going to be a unrestricted free agent after this season. Matt Hunwick has kind of leapt over John Moore. I could see Glenn dangling John Moore, see what he could get for him. You know, as far as forward depth, maybe something, you know, bottom six forward, you know, kind of a, you know, they've tried to get it out of JT Miller and it's been there at times, but right now he's kind of on the fourth line, and maybe they want someone a little more defensively responsible than JT can be at times. They haven't gotten exactly what they've wanted out of Tanner Glass, but they're locked into him with a 3-year deal. So I don't know if anyone would trade for Tanner and what they could get back for him. But I would say you go for a big physical third-pair defenseman first, and then, you know, maybe look for some bottom six forward help would be the two things I'd look at.
Andrew Gross covers the New York Rangers for the Record newspaper in New Jersey. He's a frequent guest here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Andrew, appreciate your time as always.
Anytime, guys. We'll talk soon.
Take care, Andrew. Thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, we'll look around the NHL with some NHL news and notes.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Minutes past 2 o'clock here on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. Big thanks to Andrew Gross for joining us. As always, in case you've missed any of the show or any of the great interviews we've conducted, They will be available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and on our website, illegalcurve.com. Easiest way is subscribe to the show each and every week. Get it sent straight to your iPod. Let's go around the NHL with some NHL news. iPod.
Yeah, what's wrong with your iPod?
Usually your iPhone is what it would be sent to.
I don't have an iPhone. I have an iPod.
True.
It's the same difference.
Not really.
Really? It's not still done through iTunes? What's the difference? It's, you know, any device. It serves the same purpose. I'm an old school kind of guy.
And that's apparent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's go around with some NHL news and notes if you're done interrupting me.
NHL news and notes.
Andrew Gross had two great, but unintended puns, by the way, in his answers.
Step up about Stepan?
Yeah.
What was
the
other
one? That's Mark Stahl was a stalwart defenseman.
Ah.
Yeah.
Clever.
I don't think it was intended. Really, no pun intended.
Yes. He's a cunning linguist. Anyways, the reports out of Toronto that the Leafs and Nazem Kadri are working on a five-year, $22.5 million contract, an average annual value of $4.5 million. Those reports have been disputed by other parties, but for the sake of the conversation, we'll say that they are working on that.
Wasn't that Darren Dreger report that came out?
No, he reported that that was not the case.
Okay.
But somebody else of the other place reported that it was taking that those negotiations were ongoing. Your thoughts on that kind of number for Nazem Kadri if it ends up being in and around that area?
Why 5 years? Do you know what you have there yet?
And probably not.
I don't think you do. I obviously don't see Nazem Kadri play a ton. I've seen him play quite a bit, though. And
you haven't been torturing yourself watching the Leafs?
Well, Drew, I just don't know if anybody really knows what Nazem Kadri is. Yeah, it's been a very it's been a losing environment. He's had some success. He certainly has his shortcomings. You want to see what he. I personally, this is how I feel about the Nazem Kadri situation. Randy Carlyle and him didn't necessarily get along. Horacek, your short period, we know he's not going to be the head coach next year, almost assuredly. So then you look at what he's going to be like with the next coach. Don't you want to kind of see how he plays with the next coach? How his coachability, all those things, before you lock him up to a five-year deal? That doesn't make sense to me. You go short-term here again, and short-term, I know this would be his third contract, I believe, now, right? So
yes, it would be.
So you want to go short-term, relatively speaking. I mean, you don't want to give him so much leverage, but 5 years, I think, is too much. And he's the kind of guy I wouldn't be shocked. I wouldn't be scared off by giving him, a contract to UFA status. And I say that because of this. He's from London.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Toronto guy. I mean, I know there's a lot of pressure, but the Leafs are a big team for him. So I wouldn't go 5 years on Nazem Kadri. I would see what you have first.
If you give him a two-year deal or even a three-year deal, maybe you buy out 1 year of unrestricted free agency.
I was thinking 3 years, yeah.
Okay, you buy out 1 year of unrestricted free agency. And, I mean, you know that he's a 50-point guy already because that's what he got last year, and he's going to be in and around there, maybe a little less than 50 points this year, but somewhere in that vicinity. But you're right. If he tops out at a 50-point guy, is he a $5.5 million player, or can you get him on a hometown discount? Given you said your proximity to where he's from in Toronto,
I don't know if he's earned it. Make the guy earn it. It should happen more so in the National Hockey League. Make the guy earn it.
Sure.
It's like the Jeff Skinner contract. You're getting these huge deals, and that was a second deal. This is a third deal. But even so, you're buying out so many of those years. Just relax for a second and see what you got.
In an article published on the PlayersTribune.com, which is the website where athletes can speak directly to their fan base or whatever, Tyler Seguin...
Or whatever.
What's that?
This is a new Derek Jeter site, right?
That's a new Derek Jeter site, exactly. Tyler Seguin talks about his time in Boston, and he says that the Bruins gave up on him, and, quote, he blasts those who called him a party animal. Is Tyler Seguin, was he treated unfairly in his time in Boston, or is this,
I don't know if he's treated unfairly or not. I mean, we're not in the clubs or the rooms or wherever he may be, if he is partying too hard or not. But, in terms of production, in terms of return on that deal, I mean, clearly Dallas has got the better of it. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's absolutely no question about that.
Should he still be addressing his time in Boston, or do you think it should be sort of water under the bridge at this point?
Why can't he address it? I mean, players use everything as motivation. Why wouldn't you be motivated by the fact that a team traded you with that cup aspirations? No issue with that.
Yeah, but that's a little... But
hey, he speaks his mind, and give him credit for that. No, I have no issue with that at all. And he should think that way.
Jim Jamieson of the Vancouver Province reports that the Vancouver Canucks have begun contract negotiations with pending RFA defenseman Chris Tanev.
Solid player, Drew. He's a real solid player. You know, he keeps the game pretty simple. Played some time in the Moose, too, didn't he?
Yeah.
He keeps the game real simple. And I think better than people thought. I think maybe when he came up, they thought, you know, bottom six guy, third pairing guy. He's moved his way up to a top four role. And on a team, you know, those guys are valuable. They keep everything very simple. They can move the puck. They're smart players. And I think he's a good player. You want to be locking a guy up like that, especially with Bieksa getting a little bit older.
We'll talk about Bieksa next. Tanev's coming off of a one-year, $2 million contract. He'll be an RFA on July 1st. What would you, pony up for Chris Tanev?
Well, I haven't done an evaluation of the comparables there, Drew, and stuff. But, I mean, if you're looking for a deal, you're probably looking at the, 4 years, kind of $3.5 to $4 million range, I'd say.
Yeah. He's not
off the top of my head, though.
He's not going to light it up offensively for you at any point.
No, you're looking for a solid stay-at-home guy. You're just, you know, solid. That's what you want, right?
Sure.
And sure, would you love him to get 50 points? Yeah, but you have some other guys who can produce some points there. So your main concern is getting a solid top four guy locked up.
And he's really only entering the peak of his talents because he's just only 25 years old at this point. Staying with Vancouver and on their blue line, they've lost Kevin Bieksa indefinitely with a broken hand. I don't know if you saw the highlight.
I did see that,
Taking that slap shot off the stick of Victor Hedman, getting him flush in the glove, and you could just see the pain he was in immediately told you it was not a good situation. How big of a loss for the Canucks to lose Bieksa at this point in the season?
It's a big loss, Drew. I mean, that's a team that isn't, you know, you're going to have Frankie Corrado going to have a little more responsibility here, but and some of the other guys there, but it's a team that isn't the deepest team. And I don't love Vancouver. I mean, so that's going to be tough. How do you make up for that? Now, I think you're going to be benefited by the fact that I think San Jose obviously has injuries as well, and Los Angeles has injuries, and who are you battling for in the playoffs, those two teams? So you should be able to...
Calgary, too.
Yeah, Calgary, too, but not to their big guys.
Right.
So
No, I meant Calgary, you're battling with them in the playoffs.
Yeah. So, I mean...
Calgary's only 2 points behind Vancouver.
Yeah, I think Calgary passes Vancouver.
Yeah,
I think it's a loss, but I think some of the other teams as well are going to be facing similar circumstances.
And finally, we're going to Ray Whitney announces his retirement after a 23-year NHL career.
That's a great story, Drew. I mean, a guy who's an Edmonton Oilers stick boy during the 80s for those cup-winning teams and, you know, gets in San Jose and can produce a little bit. And I remember Edmonton had him. I think Edmonton waived him, if I recall correctly. And he kind of really got another jump start to his career in Columbus. And he was a certain style of player. I mean, he wasn't the biggest guy, wasn't the fastest guy. I remember Detroit signed him. It just didn't fit into the way they played the game if you watched him play there. But such a smart player, able to read the seams really well, able to use his teammates really well. I thought I was a player that made good players better.
And smart player.
He compliment talent. And that's an underrated skill, I think. And he won his cup with Carolina there.
In 2006, yeah.
2006, and he played for an awful long time, and you can't play for that long of a time the size that he was if you're not smart. And really, I mean, a great career, especially for some of the expectations that people had for him. You know, early on in that career where people thought, maybe is he big enough to compete? You know, we talk all about Fleury, talk about St. Louis. He's right up there in terms of production over the course of that long career, and appeared to be a gentleman off the ice. I obviously don't know him personally, but appeared to be a class act as well.
Yeah, the litany of tributes that came in from people when he announced his retirement, I think, spoke volumes about what kind of player he was. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to go out to Montreal, talk about the Montreal Canadiens with Pat Hickey. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You've been so good to me. You know you make me want to sound.
2:30 in the afternoon. We want to shout here on The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Montreal Gazette in Montreal, Pat Hickey. Pat, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Always a pleasure.
Thanks again, Pat. How are you?
Good.
That's good. Pat, obviously, haven't seen a ton of the Montreal Canadiens yet this season. They haven't yet visited Winnipeg, and the Jets visited Montreal early on in the season, so we want to touch base with you. To your mind, are the Habs where they wanted to be as they enter the NHL All-Star break weekend?
Yeah, I think they're pretty happy with the way they've been playing. There have been a few dips in their schedule, but generally, I think they're pretty happy with the way they're playing. They're getting great goaltending from Carey Price. The defense is starting to gel a little bit. They're working some new guys in, but that seems to be working well. And I think the only complaint they might have is the offense. The power play has been terrible for most of the season, but they made a few adjustments there, and I think they've got seven power play goals in their last 17 opportunities, which is a turnaround from where they were early in the season. Most of the season, they were 27th, 28th, somewhere around there in the league, and they've turned that around with a few changes in personnel and how they approach the power play.
Yeah, if you look at the talent level, Pat, you would think, you know, coming into the season that wouldn't be an issue for them. Why was it an issue?
Well, I think one of the issues was everything was centered around PK Subban, and opposing teams recognized this. If you go back actually and look, you go back to last January, and teams started to realize that if you put some pressure on PK Subban, then you could probably stop the power play. And over the calendar year, from January to January, the power play was about 13% success rate, which isn't very good, especially, as you say, considering all the talent that they have out there. But what happened is that a lot of times when the puck reached PK, it stopped. It stopped moving, and you know, he didn't have the same vision as Andrei Markov has, for example. Sometimes they put a guy right in front of him and make it difficult for him to shoot. Sometimes he'd get he'd get the puck and he'd wind up and not shoot, and then wait for the guy to get in front of him. So he had a lot of shots that we had to block to wide, and now it's Markov is more and more taking over the quarterback role. For a while, they even took PK off the number one power play. He's back on there now, but I think they're more aware of the fact that they have to move it, and he has to move it. And when he gets the opportunity to shoot, he has to shoot immediately.
You mentioned PK Subban there, of course, at length. Pat, is it a blessing in disguise, maybe, that the guy who's playing over 25 minutes a game is going to get a little bit of a break here over All-Star Weekend?
Well, I think that, all the guys are, I don't think 25 minutes a game is taxing for him. I think it's more important than Andrei Markov, who I think is playing close to 25 minutes a game, gets a rest, because he's quite a bit older. I think PK could easily play 30 minutes a game and not get tired. Tremendous shape, but I don't think he was. I don't think he was particularly upset when he was left off the All-Star team.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette. Pat, you look at the Canadiens, you look at Max Pacioretty, you know, having a very good offensive year, 38 points in 45 games played. You know, to your mind, has he taken on more of a leadership role in addition to his performance on ice?
Yeah, I think he's, first of all, I think he's more confident than he's ever been. If he went into a slump before, he'd get down on himself, he'd start a lot of self-doubt. I think that scoring 39 goals last season, he realized that he is an offensive player, that he's going to have some periods where he doesn't put the puck in the net, but it doesn't mean he's not playing well. So I think that he's become more of a complete player. There was one period where he went six or seven games without a goal, but he did get some assists. He's been more aware of his role as a playmaker in the last little while. I think the fact that he's one of the four guys wearing an A, he's taken that very seriously. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point down the line, probably as early as next year, he's the captain of this team.
You know, you mentioned Andrei Markov earlier, Pat, and he has played, you know, over 24 minutes a game, a lot of minutes for an older player, but people have been kind of, you know, eager to write him off or say that, you know, his game is fading. Clearly, he's playing at a very high level. Why has he been able to continue to play at such a high level?
Well, I think for starters, he's superbly conditioned. He doesn't take any time off in the summer. You know, he might take a week decompress a little bit, but he keeps himself in tremendous shape. He and Sergei Gonchar, who's 40 years old, you know, you go out there and look at them, and, you know, they certainly don't look their age at all. I think there's a few people a little, you know, looked skeptically when he signed, Marco signed a three-year contract, but I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that he's going to fulfill that contract and be productive for those three seasons and maybe play a season beyond that. Markov has been their best defenseman. You know, there's a lot of publicity around around Subban, and he's certainly, I think Subban has the most talent on the team, but I think if you look at their production night in and night out, Markov is the more effective player, and Subban benefits from playing with him.
Pat, it's hard to find a defenseman who would be a veteran influence on Andrei Markov, but the Habs managed to do that early in the year when they acquired Sergei Gonchar from Dallas in exchange for Travis Moan. Is it fair to say that the Gonchar acquisition has been a total success for the Montreal Canadiens?
I would say so, yes. I mean, to begin with, I mean, the objective in that trade was to get rid of Moan's contract for next year. But what they have is they have a very smart defenseman. They have a veteran defenseman. There's a guy who's played with Markov before that you can see when they're out on the power play together. You can understand that they understand each other's game, and they can be very effective out there. Gonchar, even when he's on the second power play unit, smart guy. He's been around for a long time. I think a lot of people were expecting that he might be in the third defense pair, but he's been on the second pair, and now he's playing a mentor role for Nathan Beaulieu, and that so far is working out very well.
Pat, Alex Galchenyuk, you know, very well-regarded player, and the Habs have kind of eased him into, you know, his offensive role that he's in. Coming up at the end of the season, obviously the Habs have aspirations of making a run here, but coming up at the end of the season as an RFA, the Habs gave a bridge deal to P.K. Subban. Is there any talk about an extension yet for Galchenyuk? And if so, is it something really long-term or maybe shorter-term?
No, I think it'll be a short-term. I mean, they gave Gallagher a long-term deal, but I think that Galchenyuk realizes that he's only going to get better as the years go on, and that the 1 or 2 year deal will be in his favor. He's one of these guys. He's still trying to find out where he fits in this team. They moved him to center last month, and it looked like it was going to be a permanent move, but now he's back on the wing. He says he's more comfortable there. He didn't exactly. I mean, it was painted as it was his decision that you know, he wanted to be there. He said the decision was already made in his mind that Terry wanted them to move back to the left wing, but he said he was very happy with the move because he's comfortable there and less responsibility at center. He'll be a center at some point in his career, but you know, I think for right now, it's more important that he's on the wing and David Dehaene is back at center, and those are, you know, positions where the two of them feel more comfortable at this point.
Pat, we're about 5 or so weeks before the trade deadline, which means we now have to focus all the NHL's attention after this All-Star break on that as the next big day in the calendar. You know, what's Habs general manager Mark Bergevin looking to do at the trade deadline in your mind?
I think what he's looking to do is get another forward. I think he's probably looking for somebody to fill a role similar to the one that Thomas Vanek filled last year, a rental. You know, he's happy with the core of his team, and he's got a couple of young guys in Junior, Nikita Sherbak and Michael McCarron, who are going to give him some size and strength in down the future. So he doesn't want to pick up anybody who's going to have a long-term commitment, or it's going to disturb his salary cap. So you're looking at basically a guy who's going to be a rental player, someone who can maybe fill in on the power play, someone with some size. Jaromir Jagr is one of the guys who's been mentioned. Of course, over the years, the Canadians have had opportunities to sign Jaromir Jagr. He's a good friend of Thomas Plekanec, but they haven't been able to get a deal done. And I think it's mostly reluctance on the Canadians' part. And one former player who knows, who's played with Jagr, he said that one of the things the Canadians might be wary of is the fact that Yarmir would suck a lot of the energy out of the room. It remains to be seen whether they'll go that route. Some other players have been mentioned, but I think that's the route they'll go, is to try to get somebody with some size, someone who's on a team that's and I think it'll be done before the trading deadline. Now, last year they went right up to the final minutes before signing Vanek or getting Vanek from
right.
I think it might be done sooner this time.
Pat, I lied. This is going to be the second last question. You know, do you get the sense that there's any attitude in the Canadiens dressing room that sort of resents how the season ended last year with Carey Price going down in the conference finals, you know, not being able to play with the injury, and maybe that they're sort of using that as motivation, saying, this is our year, we're going to be healthy, hopefully we're going to get to the Stanley Cup finals as a result?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that, you know, their goal is to get to the Stanley Cup final. I think that while there's some feeling that, you know, maybe things, you know, might have gone differently last year, they still got a good performance from Dustin Tokarski. And I think one of the things that happened last year was that, when Price went down, the first game back, first game in the New York Rangers series, they had no energy left after beating Boston. And so there was a natural letdown there. And then when Price got hurt, I think, and they decided to go with Tokarski rather than Peter Budaj, I think there was a feeling on the team that maybe they thought that Therrien might be giving up, that, you know, here was they going into a third-string goaltender, guy with limited experience. And it took them a game to realize that Tokarski could play. And then they made a series out of it. They lost 1-0 in game six. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they were right into it. And I think they know that they can play better. But I think at the same time, they also realize there are a lot of obstacles in front of them in the Eastern Conference. The one that has to worry them the most is Tampa Bay. Now, they swept Tampa Bay in the first round of the playoffs last year, but they didn't have Ben Bishop in there. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make a big difference if he's in there. This year, the Canadiens have played them twice, and I think they've been outscored 9-2 or 9-3.
It'll be interesting to watch as we head into the stretch drive. Pat Hickey covers the Montreal Canadiens for the Montreal Gazette. Pat, appreciate your time as always.
Anytime, guys.
Thanks very much. Let's head to break. When we come back, one final segment on this Saturday afternoon. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One final segment here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on this Saturday afternoon. You know it. You love it. It's Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire.
Show's gone by quick.
Rapidly, if you would.
You gotta get rid of You Know It, You Love It.
You don't like You Know It,
no,
You Love It?
I don't like it.
No.
I don't love it. I don't love it. I don't even think I like it.
Fine, I'll think of something new for you next week.
Okay.
In a column published earlier this week, Dejan Kovacevic claims that Tuesday night's fight night between the Flyers and Penguins was pre-orchestrated by the team from Philadelphia, and that, quote, the Flyers are the most repugnant franchise in professional sports, with all due apologies to Bill Belichick's Patriots. Who should be more insulted, the Flyers organization or the Patriots organization?
Probably the Flyers organization, Drew. I don't think anything was pre-orchestrated there. I just don't believe that. And I think, you know, if you're looking at the old Flyers way of doing things, maybe Ron Hextall, while you may think of him as being a little more, you know, as the Flyers of the 80s and 90s, but in reality, I think he's a little bit more cutting edge than people give him credit for. And then the truth is, you know, Zach Rinaldo's is a dirty player, and that was a dirty play. But, I mean, Jakub Voracek, taking exception to Rob Scuderi's, low hit, I have no issue with a star player dropping the gloves and going at it. And then the rest of that kind of – rest of the fights I thought emanated from that play. So I think that's overstating it a little bit there. We'll get into Deflategate another time.
We got into it off the air. What do you think, Deflategate? Much ado about nothing or something?
I don't play football at the NFL level. I don't know the difference that the balls that can make. But – I saw some players, I was watching SportsCenter the other night, they were talking about how it would make a significant difference. So I don't know. I just think that, you know, if these guys are cheating, I hate the explanation is, well, whatever, they would have won anyway. It doesn't mean that they didn't cheat. It doesn't mean they didn't give them an edge in the game. Maybe it gave them an edge early in the game and made, maybe they got early. I know they made a big run in the third quarter, but maybe they get a touchdown and the team presses because that team was able to get a touchdown easier because of the balls. I don't know. I just can't stand that these teams continue to cheat. And these teams don't need to. Like, why do the Patriots need to do that?
I don't think that they need to do
that. If they did
well,
do that,
I think every team does it, to be honest. I think just
why
certain
don't they
teams,
all get busted then?
Well, because I think certain teams are more under the microscope than other teams. But I think every team does it.
Well, that's your take.
That is my take. It's a hot take. There's been so many hot takes about Balgazi or Deflategate. I'm not sure which one I prefer more. Anyways.
Stick to us.
Okay. Well. After the Predators lost in overtime to Montreal on Tuesday night, Predators forward Mike Ribeiro said, quote, "I think it was a game we should have won. I think we were robbed by the refs," and quote, "It's sad that a good game like that is decided by bad calls from the refs." Given his reputation, how much weight do you give to any criticisms leveled by Mike Ribeiro?
I don't know. Do I think it's an emotional player getting mad about the referees? I don't even mind when he does speak his mind in that case. Overall, I mean, obviously, Mike Ribeiro is a serial diver, and you know that hits his reputation. So I think I hear him out there, but I think the refs will give him less weight in terms of what he says. You know, that's what happens. You can't second blow. You can't always, you know, put the refs in a bad position and suddenly want a call or two when it matters most.
Fair enough. I think that's well articulated by yourself.
Sounds like you weren't listening if you said the word well-argulated.
No, well-argulated is not a word, unfortunately. But in any event, Zach Rinaldo is facing NHL supplemental discipline after his hit on Chris Letang on Tuesday's Flyers-Penguins game. Here's what he said post-game.
Hit him backside of the shoulder. Just, I don't know, maybe the power of my hit. His head hit the glass, and yeah. I didn't hit him from behind. I hit him from the numbers, backside of the shoulder. That's how I saw it. If you slow it down, any hit, you see guys every single hit. If you slow it down and dissect every single little detail, you're going to see something that you can criticize. Yeah, I changed the whole game, man. Who knows what the game would have been like if you know, I didn't do what I did.
Your thoughts on those comments from Zach Rinaldo post-game? And secondly, should those post-game comments be used against him when the NHL hands out supplemental discipline in their hearing with him on Monday?
I don't like the comments. I think if you watch the play, the fact that he thinks that he didn't hit him from behind is kind of scary, and it's not knowing the ramifications of your actions. So that's concerning. I spoke at length on Tuesday's show about my feelings about Zach Rinaldo and his seemingly lack of regard for where the puck is during the course of the play. His comments, you know, part of me says, well, it's an emotional reaction after a game, even if he was kicked out, that the Flyers had won in overtime. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't really put too much thought into it, if you assume that he puts thought into anything that he says. The other part of me says, well, I mean, if this is this is the background of his intentions, then it should be factored into it. And I probably lean more towards the latter than I would the former.
Phil Kessel went second overall last night in the NHL's All-Star Game Fantasy Draft. After drafting,
boy, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised that the World Cup's such a disgrace when you have to watch stuff like that last night.
Last night's was tolerable.
No, I realize, but just the idea of it. Yeah, like, it's just like.
Well, I know, but
last night was tolerable because the players didn't take it seriously, which is what they should be doing. I think the players were awesome.
Yeah,
you know, from the clips that I saw, I wasn't able to see the whole thing, but
yeah, you don't want to sit down and watch that entire.
No,
thing.
No, but you know, I just again like these ideas.
I know everything's so complicated. After drafting Phil Kessel, team captain Jonathan Toews said it was Kessel's quote coachability that made him such an appealing selection. On a scale of 1 to 10, and knowing the lack of public personality from many NHL players, how good of a zinger was that by Toews?
That's a pretty good one. Yeah, stick up, but that's a brotherhood.
Yeah.
And maybe not as respectful as it once was, but it's a brotherhood, and so I like that, going out there and kind of throwing everybody under the bus a little bit.
I think it's still a pretty good brotherhood among the players of that caliber.
I don't know about that, but...
How many really dirty players are... You know, really are in the upper echelon that like most of the all-star players are.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you still have your Crosby, Giroux kind of hatred stuff, but I actually don't even mind that. Like, that's a competitive hatred, it appears.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, that's a fair point, Drew, in terms amongst those guys. But amongst the league in general, I think it's certainly not what it once was.
Right, but that's a pretty good zinger by Toews there.
It is. Yeah, well, I like it. I mean, hey, Jonathan Toews can say whatever he wants, really.
Yeah. Continuing with last night's fantasy draft, it was tolerable mainly because the players allegedly were completely hammered.
Allegedly.
Would you be more?
You watched it.
I watched about 30 minutes of it, and
were they?
They really weren't paying attention.
Why should they be?
They shouldn't be.
It's less intense than having your own fantasy draft.
Yeah. The broadcasters would be asking them questions and the players weren't paying attention and they'd be like, who, me? You're talking to me? It's like, I got distracted. I wasn't listening to the question.
What happened with Ovechkin there? He was making a scene.
Well,
right?
Ovechkin was lobbying to be the last player picked to get
he wanted the car.
He wanted the car. Because I'm sure.
But it was Philip Forsberg, right?
It was Forsberg and Ryan Nugent Hopkins. They both get a car as a result. Yeah.
So both on the lot. Okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, apparently Ovechkin just bought a $250,000 car, but he's going to drive a Honda Accord at the same time, apparently. Anyways, would you be more or less likely to watch the All-Star game if the players were able to drink well on the bench between shifts?
Seems like a safety hazard, Drew. I don't know. I don't know if that would be.
It's real, like real beer league hockey at that point in time.
Yeah. I'd be more apt to watch it. I'm not going to watch the game, so I guess. Yeah, maybe I'd tune in to see what it would be like.
Exactly. There's no chance you're watching it now.
Seems like a bit of a liability trap.
Yeah, and the last question about the fantasy draft last night. Who won the trade that was made? Team Taves, who acquired Tyler Seguin, or Team Foligno, who acquired Phil Kessel?
Was that also made in light of the actual trade of basically
of
those
course.
Two players?
That's exactly why.
I like where they're going with that. The players having some fun.
Yeah.
Who won the trade? I think the Seguin team still wins the trade. But, I mean, if you ever thought when that trade was made, when Toronto, I mean, and they obviously didn't think they were going to finish that low in the standings. But, I mean, Phil Kessel, performance-wise, just numbers-wise, has at least met, if not exceeded, expectations for what they thought they were getting from Boston there.
Sure.
So, I Brian Burke made a bunch of moves that probably weren't great. That one certainly set them back quite a bit, especially with where they finished in the standings. But the one trade that you can give them a lot of credit for was the James Van Riemsdyk trade.
Yeah, for Luke Shen.
Luke Shen, yeah. Who, by the way, in that Philly game, just beat the living hell out of Steve Downey.
That's right.
My God.
And Voracek beat up. I can't remember who Voracek beat up.
Scuderi. That was Scuderi's first fight, though.
Okay.
And that was actually surprising. Scuderi had never been in an NHL fight before, and Voracek went to town on him. But Luke Shen on Steve Downey, and I know he's bigger than Downey, but Steve Downey, who's dropped the gloves before in his career, that was quite the performance there.
It certainly was.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And cheers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stink like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Go ahead, Rich, first.
Well, Drew, I think you know what my jersey is going to be today.
Yeah, I think I do.
Not the NHL All-Star jerseys. Not the NHL. It's going to be the World Cup. And this is an easy one. And I went on about it in the first hour. The fact that they've made this tournament into a complete joke is astounding. It is. Maybe some people involved you wouldn't think so unexpected, but it hurts the game. And jokes aside, it hurts the game. And it hurts the fan interest, I think. And hurts the spirit of the tournament. And you've turned what was the Canada Cup and some of the greatest hockey you've ever seen in 1987, for example. You watched those three games and TSN had them on, you know, during the lockout. That's some of the best hockey you'll ever see. And you've now taken that and made it essentially a joke because that would not have the same meaning as it once did. And if they opt out in the Olympics, then fans are really missing out.
I'll wrap up Cheers and Jeers by cheering everybody that's nominated for tomorrow night's Manitoba Sports Writers and Sportscasters Association 59th annual Athletes of the Year dinner. So congratulations to all the nominees there, and as well congratulations to the 2014 Media Role of Honor nominees, longtime voice of the Brandon Wheat Kings, Bruce Lubke, and longtime sports editor and columnist with the Winnipeg Sun, Patty Dawn Swanson. Congratulations to them both on their induction into the Manitoba Sports Writer and Sportscaster Role of Honor. That's it for the Saturday afternoon here in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Big thanks to our guest, Mike Colligan, who covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. Big thank you to Tom Lynn, author of How to Bake an NHL Franchise from Scratch. Big thank you to Andrew Gross from the Record newspaper in New Jersey. And big thank you to Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette. In case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and on illegalcurve.com. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Bernstein's Deli, and Linden Market Dental Center. Follow us on Twitter, at illegalcurve, facebook.com/illegalcurve. For producer Chris, go see his band tonight in the garage. Yeah. For producer Remus, for analyst Richard Pollock, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca.